What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Kropczyk. And John, there's no question that a lot of people are getting older, younger. Well, I mean, or younger, older, or something. I mean, the baby boomers, this huge conglomerate of people who can't imagine getting older, somehow, regardless,
I've noticed that. There's
doing
always
it.
Some old people around.
Yeah, and I always know that there's a new batch of old people walking around. How did they become older than me? Because they, at one time, were not old, and yet they seem a lot older than I am. And yet I'm old, so I don't know. But there are a lot of people out there saying, look, we are not going to age like the generations before us. We're different. And baby boomers in particular saying, nah, that's not the way we age. I mean, look at our rock stars are still out there. Paul McCartney and Ringo and Mick Jagger.
There's some of the few that actually look good, but most of them don't look so good. The old sex, drugs, and rock and roll didn't go too well.
Well, but I'll tell you, when you think about it, Keith Richards still being alive, I mean, there is something to be said for that rock and roll lifestyle. But I just think we are very, reluctant to imagine that the world, A, can go on without us, and that we are going to age to a point where some of the things that we enjoy, like rock and roll, are not going to be part of our lives anymore. I mean, if people look at us and say, you must want to listen only to Tony Bennett, and we say, no, Metallica, that's what I like. No, really, isn't that a little odd when you see
true.
A 72-year-old right, saying Metallica is still my favorite group?
Right, that is, you're right. You think of Frank or Dean.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the music of your life. Whose life? So the question is, how are we trying to disrupt the process of aging? I mean, how are you? Well, you're borderline getting older.
Thank you.
Well, he looks older than the last time I saw.
I feel a little older.
Yeah, and I saw you 5 days ago. But the question is, what are we trying to do to disrupt aging, those of us who are now rising to that level? And, you know, even the issue of what do we want to be called? Because there's been a dispute about senior citizens. Is that, you know, older Americans?
Classic. How about classic?
Classic. Yes. Like classic Coke?
Yeah, like we're classic.
Well, that did better than the new Coke. But when you do think about it, people are using terms like vintage or evergreen or whatever it may be. But there really is a new movement out there, John. And there are a lot of people who are saying that some of the things that we built for other generations won't work as well for this generation. Even isolating us into places where you have only seniors may not be the best way to stimulate people who need.
I think that would be terrible.
So if only people your age.
Yeah, I think you need that. You need the, you know, give and take of other people. You know?
So young people around, yeah. Children.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. So disrupt aging. There's a book out by Joanne Jenkins, and she's the CEO of AARP. And she says, this gives you a blueprint for a bold new path to living your best life at every age. So the folks at AARP in our state of Connecticut are one of the early adapters to this program called Disrupt Aging. And John, I've got to tell you, and I do say it in the podcast, that I went to one of these seminars that they hold.
Oh, is that you that got arrested for protesting out there?
What did I protest? That I was getting older and it's not
aging.
Fair?
Yeah.
And I'm not going to accept this sitting down?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, they had these really interesting workbooks at this. And for example, in the reflections portion, how do you think about aging? And so they wanted you, without any prompts, to list three words that come to mind when you think about aging.
Wow. Boy, that's tough.
Well, I mean, a lot of people do then get into things like decrepitude or whatever. And that's not really what you want to be thinking about.
No.
So I do reveal in this podcast what initially came to mind for me when I was asked this question. So if you're thinking about your future and how you disrupt aging and how you stay stimulated and how you look forward and not look back, I mean, there is a tendency, let's be honest, John, for many of us, a lot of the people who really have defined our lives are not with us any longer. Our parents.
That's true. That is very
certain
true.
Friends.
Yep.
And when you begin to identify more with them than you do the people who are with you today, I think it can become a very difficult thing to accept. But you've got to move on.
Yeah, you can't get depressed. You got to keep moving.
And we find that there are a lot of people who, because of chronic disease and the like, just don't move as quickly, do have certain limits that they have placed on their bodies. And it's really unfortunate. I mean, it really is. So we're going to talk about this whole process of disruption as
right.
it relates to aging.
Okay.
And we have two representatives from our state of Connecticut, but they speak to the issue nationally today on America Trends. Joining us on America Trends is Tia Murphy, and she is the president for AARP in Connecticut. And Donna Fettis is a gerontologist and founder of Borrow My Glasses. Now, first, Donna, I've got to ask you, Borrow My Glasses, what does that refer to?
Well, Borrow My Glasses is a metaphor. It's all about our philosophy. We are assisting companies, individuals to see aging and caregiving issues from a new perspective.
Ah, okay. So kind of walk a mile in my shoes?
Exactly. I think it's true. Everyone sees the world from their own perspective. And often, so I'm a gerontologist. I've been in the field for almost 30 years now. And I find that most people don't like to think about aging. They don't like to look at aging. They like to defy it and deny it. And I think people really need to look at this new phase of life that's so interesting and exciting. So that's kind of one thing right off the bat. We want people to see the whole phase of life from a new perspective.
Well, let's be honest about it. So many of us are growing older together, and many of us, the baby boom generation, we just cannot imagine that we're still not 25, 30, 40, the hippest, the rockers, that we had the best music, we had the best everything. So we're having a hard time admitting, perhaps, that we're aging, but thankfully, we have so many role models that I think are helping us today to think about this. So when I see Paul McCartney out there or Mick Jagger still rocking it, I'm still in a rock band, and I see a president who's 71. I see presidential candidates like Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders who are well into their 70s. Nancy Pelosi likely to be the speaker again when we record this, approaching 80. So that gives us a lot to think about, doesn't it? In a better way than perhaps that notion of a doddering old person. Tia, what do you say to that?
You know, the most interesting thing is aging is a natural process like everything else. If you think about it, every time you take a breath, you age, right? So it's been happening since the moment you came out of your mother. You've been aging. Growing, developing, etc. And I think, you know, you bring up a great point. The baby boomers, we're not going to age like our parents aged. I'm 65. I just turned 65 in October. And thrilled, you know, proud Medicare card carrier, I should say. But when my grandmother was my age, she was a very old woman. Still had a lot of energy and enthusiasm and certainly a lot of opinions about the world, but physically she had a lot of ailments and she had worked a hard life. I'm 65. I do all sorts of things that people half my age are always like, I bird a lot. People are always like, oh, well, you know, Tia, don't go too fast up that hill. I'm at the top of the hill and the young kids are like behind me going, how'd she do that? And it's just a matter of will and desire. But I think baby boomers, we're not going to take it. We changed the world when we were younger. We're changing the world again. And we are part of this movement. And we're going to make aging, we are disrupting aging. truly.
Absolutely. Now, I know that Joanne Jenkins, who is the CEO of AARP, wrote the book, Disrupt Aging, A Bold New Path to Living Your Best Life at Every Age. And I know that AARP has, throughout the country, adopted that philosophy, and there are different programs going on across the country. We are recording this in the state of Connecticut. So how broad a scope does this disrupt aging process and program within AARP have across the country? What kinds of programming are you doing? And what kinds of things are you trying to dispel in terms of the myths about aging?
Well, I'll take that first. This is Tia. From an AARP perspective, we in Connecticut looked at this and said, you know what? We really want to change the way people are thinking about aging, and we want to be as intergenerational as we possibly can with this. We want to help educate people about how to live their best possible lives, which was a huge part of the philosophy of AARP, and we want to make sure we want to take that message out to everyone. So we put a program together with a slide presentation that we go out. We have a workbook that we use. It helps people to think about aging in a completely different way. I was just at a big convention, a livability, AARP livability convention down in Charlotte, North Carolina, talking to a lot of people about the kinds of disrupt aging programs that they were doing out there. And every state does it a little differently because everyone's got different issues. If you think about it, here in Connecticut, we are, I believe, the seventh oldest state, and we will continue to be a very aged state. So making sure that our cohort is aging well and is aware of what it means to age well and gives tools to be able to age well and think positively about this time of our lives and be productive, that's really what we're all about. And they're doing the same things in different states, but everybody does it a little bit differently.
One of the things that worries me, I will say, living in the Northeast, and I'm now the oldest person in this room, I'm 66, but I don't feel it. And I'm very active and very involved. But then again, my body doesn't have that many miles on it. I haven't really worked with my body over the years. And that does make a difference. There are people who have a lot of chronic conditions because their body really has been exercised in ways that have been very difficult in different extreme conditions and under a lot of pressure. But I do want to say this, that I worry in the Northeast when it comes to aging and the way our housing is set up, and this goes across to the Midwest as well, that a lot of people are socially isolated as they age. They've lost their spouse. And I was in a grocery store last year, and I think we had had about 2 weeks of really bad weather. And I heard this woman, I overheard the conversation with the cashier, saying, "This is the first time I've been out of my house in 2 weeks." That is not a good situation. And yet, how do policymakers respond to the fact that people really need interaction? They need socialization. That's as important to our health as anything else. Donna, you're a gerontologist. Help us understand this.
You raise a good point, and you absolutely raise a good point, and I feel like it's something that the world will be grappling with, especially in the decades to come. So this year, the oldest baby boomer is just 72. So that's incredible, thinking that between now and, say, the year 2050, 2060, the population 65 plus will double what we have now. And so these homes that were all built as single family homes after World War II, and that's what everyone wanted, to own their own home and have their own neighborhood. And, you know, it was a wonderful way for a lot of people to live. And if you ask people and you look at research, most people will say they do want to age in their home. They don't want to have to move. But those homes weren't built for older adults. They weren't built for single people. They were built with stairs. They were very isolating when the neighborhood, you know, grows up and the kids move out and so on. So you're making a great point. It's a tricky situation because, of course, you want to have people achieve their choice. So borrow their glasses, right? If they want to stay home, you want to try to make that possible. For some individuals, that's absolutely the best thing for them. But it is very isolating. And so sometimes living in a congregate setting or living in a group setting is more appropriate for people.
However, having said that, Joseph Coughlin, who heads the MIT Aging Lab, wrote a great book called The Longevity Economy, saying that, number one, we're not taking into account the importance of the buying power of this group. I love that notion. Well, if you always drove a Buick, then that's all you're going to buy, so why should we try to get you over to a Subaru or a Toyota or whatever it may be? It's so ridiculous, because I think as you get older, your ideas about what you want and need do change. But he also suggested that those places like the Villages in Florida, which is a city unto itself, are not the best place to age because you're isolating yourself from other generations. Tia, what's your reaction to that? And Donna, too.
You know, it's interesting. I stepped out of my corporate career to take care of my dad, and I moved into a neighborhood in Connecticut where my parents had been for 27 years. I live in a community. Everybody knows each other. I know their children. I know their children who are now raising children. And so I'm sort of everybody's aunt. I'm everybody's great aunt. I'm like everybody's grandmother. It's fabulous. I love it. But so we all, you know, I intend to age in place. And there are a lot of things that you can do to allow yourself to be able to live in place. The key thing is, you know, you talk about social isolation. One of the most important things is for people to find things outside of just their everyday activities to keep them connected. Because there are a lot of benefits in social interaction. So as long as people can still continue to be connected with their neighbors, with their community, it's going to be very, very important. So what are some things? AARP is also doing a lot of aging in place and livability. Like I said, I've just come from a livability conference. And this is one of the issues that we were talking about. How do we deal with isolation? How do we set up communication groups so that if I know, for example, that you're somebody who lives by themselves and we just had this big snowstorm, like in my neighborhood, I had two or three of my neighbors call me up. How you doing, Tia? I saw you got your snowblower out. How'd that work? You know, do you need anything from the store? What are you doing for Thanksgiving? What are you doing here? What are you doing there? So I think that's the main thing, is that you're still connected and in a community. I agree that it's very isolating if all I ever saw were people who looked like me in terms of age, that would be a very depressing thing. I love having the kids come around. I love having these 30, 40, 50-year-olds around me because I learn a lot. They learn a lot. I learn a lot. We exchange a lot of information. So I think that's critically important too. This intergenerational aspect is critically important. I think when a lot of us were younger, I grew up in the cohort of my grandparents, my parents, and my cousins. My niece and nephew don't have all of those cousins that I had. They don't have that intergenerational kind of aspect to things. And it's something that they're looking for.
Well, Donna, I mean, across the country, there were all of these established 55 and older communities, and the Villages perhaps being the largest among those. And now I know that in the state of Connecticut, for example, in one small community, Bethany, they're building almost a commune, some people might call it, but where it's going to be intergenerational. And the idea being that the older person who's home during the day might be able to help somebody to have less expense related to daycare, and they'll be stimulated, motivated, taking care of younger children, so on and so forth. And it's looking to take various things that the wisdom and time have given to one generation to help that other generation as they're scurrying around trying to make a living and support a family. So are you looking at anything across the country that suggests that one way to disrupt aging is to make certain that we're not all self-selecting and segregating ourselves by age alone?
Absolutely. So you're bringing up an interesting point. So the village movement actually, which is different from a 55 plus community, but the village concept or movement started in Boston. And Beacon Hill Village was the first in that group. And they said, you know what, we're getting older, but we don't want to leave our homes. We love our community, like Tia was saying, and we want to stay here. And so that group banded together and said, we're going to become a membership kind of organization. We're all going to pay a little bit of money. We're going to stay in our homes, and we will band together for certain purposes that help us stay there. So they have discounts with local service providers, you know, plumbers, roofers, yard work, chores, that kind of thing, tour service. They can sometimes get a discount, but they have vetted professionals who are available to help them. Sometimes they do health education things together. They help each other with transportation and that kind of a thing. So that village concept is springing up. There are hundreds of them now around the country. We have several here in Connecticut, in New Canaan and Hamden. The shoreline area of Connecticut has one. Darien at Home is a little bit different, but they have something like that in their community. So that's one model. The 55 plus model is a little bit different. I really love the idea of an intergenerational community like that, because often when we think of that kind of community, we think of age segregated. And that works for some people too, I have to say. What I think the issue is, though, is up until now, we've only had a very few number of choices. And so, for instance, even assisted living, it's like the model that we have is sort of a luxury hotel kind of a living model. And that's wonderful for some people. It really provides so much stimulation and activities and safety net and, you know, interesting food choices and so on. But that's only one model. So I think what you're describing, an intergenerational kind of a model of community living where you're staying in a community setting, not in one or a few buildings on a campus, is very interesting. And I feel like you talked about being a rocker, and I think affinity groups are going to start to get together more and more and say, hey, we want to live with other people with our interests or our lifestyle or things that are important to us.
Well, our group is called BOOM, and we call it that because we know it to be a band of old men.
Yeah.
But we don't like to say that too often and too out loud. Now, I got to ask you this. In the Wall Street Journal several months ago, there was this article, Forget Senior, Boomers Search for a Better Term. Now, everything in America is about branding. Mm. Everybody's got to have a label so that we can perhaps fit it in a box. But this whole notion of being a senior, I've got to admit that to me, it's a tough thing to swallow at times. It's like, well, what does that mean to you about me? Does that mean that the best years of my life are past? That the productive part of my life is past? No, I don't want it to think that. In fact, I'm flowering now and spreading my wings in ways that I wouldn't be able to when I was limited to one focus. But we do have a hard time, elder, older, adult, perennial, cool, sage, senior, mature. I mean, what do we want to be called? I mean, this is part of disrupting aging, is to having a better label for it. No, Tia?
You know, it is, but and as Americans, and as a former marketer who, you know, frankly, labeled a lot of things, a lot of different things for many years, I made a very good career about doing that. I do think it's one of the things that we're searching for. But here's the question: do we really want it to be just about a chronological age, or do we want it to be more about a philosophy and a way of thinking about things? To me, it's really, this is like a new time in my life. This is not, I'm retired. I'm thrilled that I'm retired. You know what? Because I, like you, I'm doing many more things than I did before when I was in my corporate career. I followed that. It was hard to branch out into other things. Now I have so
many. Well, you're consumed by that. And the other obligations, I know, raising a family. I mean, I just kept looking straight ahead. I didn't have time to dream as much as, luckily, the jobs that I had allowed me to dream. It was a creative career. But what I'm saying is a lot of people just have to keep their head focused and down and keep moving in a straight line rather than looking around.
Yeah, and I think we are struggling with how to characterize it, what to call it. But I think more important than that is for us to think about, what does it mean? What are we talking about? And from that, just like when you're in a creative environment, something will come out of it that will define for us what it's called. But I think the critical thing really is to have us all not think about this as being an end point, but a beginning point, a new time, a time of blossoming. And I think the other thing is to also understand that just like every 20, a cohort of 20-year-olds are all different, a cohort of people who are 65, 60, whatever, plus, we're all different too. So as Donna was saying, you know, a 55-plus community makes sense for some people. Living the way I live makes sense for other people. Everyone's different.
Well, you look at a 60-year-old today versus, as you said, a 60-year-old of the past. It's a totally different experience because of health care and nutrition and lifestyle and so forth. The question is, I mean, we're really looking now at about a third of our lives or perhaps even more. And is this even the point at which jumping off is going to be the norm? Is it going to be in the 60s or is it going to be in the 70s or 80s as we move along in terms of longevity?
So our mindsets about aging have not caught up with the reality of aging today. And I think that that is a really important point to make. We actually do make that in one of our Disrupt Aging courses that we give. So the idea of people think of someone 65, 70, 75, 80, 85, whatever the number is, in a certain way. And then when you say, well, what about your Uncle Joe? What about your Aunt Tia? What about your grandmother? Oh, no, my grandmother's not that way. But most people that age are this way. They don't get out much. They're depressed. They don't have enough money to meet their needs. They're very unhealthy, but not my people, but most people. And honestly, it's not true. So the ideas that we have about aging, I think it's one thing that makes the terms not fit anymore. We don't live our lives in the same way that people even one or two generations ago were living their lives. It's really changed drastically and in unprecedented ways in the course of human history. So here's a startling statistic. Two-thirds of anyone who's ever reached the age of 65 is alive today. Like, this is historically unprecedented. And so, you know, consequently, we're sort of breaking the mold and trying to figure out, it's like, what's that saying about building the plane while you're flying it? You know, that's sort of what's happening.
I know what we're
doing.
So
people who are on the edge there, we call that sometimes leading edge boomers, right? Your oldest baby boomers, but really all boomers, and the people who are older today, the silent generation, are trailblazers, trendsetters. So it's sort of a wide open field about what aging.
So what are our expectations as baby boomers who are aging and hopefully in health? What do we want out of this phase of life? What are we demanding of policymakers and others, marketers? What do we want from them?
I think what the first thing is absolute respect, because, you know, everybody should respect each other, but really respect for the fact that we have a lot to still continue to give. So there's that. I think the other thing that we want out of it is to make something about our life to be meaningful. It's not like when my dad retired and what his goal, although he never really did this, when he retired was to just sort of sit in his chair and smoke his pipe and pet the dog. That was it. That's not what he wound up doing. He started his own business and so on and so forth. So he was kind of a vanguard of that. But I see that in a lot of people my age, us boomers, that's one of the things that we're really looking at is what's the more meaningful things that we can do out of our life? Retirement does not mean I'm going to sit back. It just means I'm released from this other captivity that
and it
I
doesn't
was in.
Even mean that you're not going to work. I just
exactly.
finished a consulting project that was about 6 months, but it gave me fluidity. I could be there certain days and not other days. I was still involved, very active, creating something, and yet it wasn't all consuming.
And the other thing is that sometimes volunteering is a much more satisfactory way of going about doing things than working for pay. And some people continue to work. Matter of fact, one of the reasons why AARP is no longer the RP is not for retired persons is because we looked at our cohort, all of our members, and we realized that a very large portion of our members were working well late in years, and not always because they had to, but they wanted to. It made them feel, it enriched them, not just financially, but also from a perspective of they had a place to go and a thing to do every day.
And I didn't want to do a daily talk show any longer, but I decided to go into this whole new realm of podcasting and haven't made a lot of money on it, but I'm having a ball with it, talking to people like you and staying stimulated. And that's the point. You can take whatever it is your skill set is and you can adapt it to a new environment so that you're still doing it, but you're not consumed by it. Is that what a lot of people are finding, Donna?
It is. And so that's kind of a great example of the way that life has shifted. So it used to be that you would have all of your education early in your life in one block of time. And then you would have all of your working years and, you know, next and in another block of time. And then you would have your leisure years and that, you know, that beautiful image of rocking in your rocking chair and doing nothing because you've been working so hard for all those years. That's where that came from. But when people were dreaming about that, they really didn't have that many years in retirement. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, in fact, when they started giving Social Security at age 65, not too many people collected, or if they did, it's only for 2 or 3 years. So the whole notion is different. So now if you say 65 as a retirement age, which was just, you know, picked arbitrarily, but you're like, well, I'm very likely going to live another 20 years, another 30 years, maybe more than that. That's more time than before you started working. And so the idea of organizing life in blocks like that, of linear fashion, is really no longer working. So I'm a professor at Quinnipiac University. I used to work at Yale, and I used to do this exercise called an age line where I would have people kind of write down markers, exciting moments or milestone moments in their life. And it used to be that all those milestone moments came earlier in your life.
Oh, getting married, having a child,
your
first job.
Graduating from high school, then maybe college and getting all these things. And then as they went on, maybe retirement was big and then people didn't really have a lot of interesting milestones. But I started doing this exercise maybe 30 years ago when I was a student because I had a class where it was done and I experienced it. And in more recent years, I can't do an age line and come up with the same points because people are like, well, I went back to school after I retired. You know, oh, I started a new career. I just jumped out of a plane because it was on my bucket list and I always wanted to do that. I'm 79, you know, and I know someone who's 90 who jumped out of a plane and went skydiving. So it really
Well, didn't the first President Bush do that recently,
yes.
Didn't he?
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. I was in one of your workshops. And you asked us all to come up with three words to describe how we think about aging. And then later you asked people what they had come up with. And I put, well, three things that are a little incongruous. One was freedom from the daily 9-to-5 grind. Reconnection, which I think is really important at this stage where you say, hey, these are the things that really count. And let me reach out to someone I hadn't talked to in years. Let me reconnect with things that were always important to me, but had been sidelined. But the other, I did put limitation, meaning thinking that as I get older, there's that go-go period of retirement or this phase, there's the slow go, and then there's the no-go. So I started looking ahead at perhaps some limitations. But you, I think, Tia, did this workshop, and there were lots of negative words, not just all adjectives, but all kinds of words, nouns and adjectives, that came out of this.
You know, and it's interesting. When we do this workshop, it's one of the first things we do is we say, write down, don't think a lot about this, write down three words, right quick, that when you think of the word aging, what is it? And then we go through the workshop. And then at the end of the workshop, we say, okay, so have those words changed? And it's interesting how many times people will say, you know, my words were, I was thinking about, I was going to be decrepit. I was going to be tired. I was going to be depressed. I, you know, was, like you're saying, looking at limitations. But after I've been through this workshop and thinking about what you've talked about, I realize that I'm actually experiencing things and doing things that I hadn't been able to do before. And while I may have some physical limitations, one woman said, I had physical limitations when I was in my teen years because I was very short, you know, and so there were certain things I couldn't do and I wasn't very strong. But you know, so I have some limitations now, but I overcame them when I was a teen, and I'm going to overcome them now when I'm in my 70s and 80s. That's the kind of attitude that we're looking for, because when you look at something that limits you, as long as you accept that as a limit, you're right, it is. If you look at it and say, maybe I can't do things quite the same. I garden. I don't garden the way I used to garden, okay? When I was younger, it was all annuals, flowers, vegetables, blah, blah, blah. I do a lot of container gardening now. Perennials are my friends. But I will tell you what, I'm still an avid gardener. And when people come to my home, they're like, look at your gardens. They're great. And I'm thinking, yeah, well, if you had seen them a couple of years ago, they would have looked, I have pictures of them. They look totally different because I've changed. So I've adapted over time how I do things. I'm still a gardener. I'm still a birder, but I do it differently than I did before. So I'm accommodating for where I am and frankly, what's of interest to me. I used to spend almost all my free time gardening. I don't want to do that anymore, right? I don't want to be spending all my time weeding. I'm just going to water those containers and head on down and have myself some fun.
Well, when you think about America, and Donna, because you are a gerontologist, I think of America historically as a very youth-oriented culture, the old Pepsi generation. And our symbols are often of the lean and the fit and the beautiful and the daring. How much does that, by process of exclusion, relegate older Americans to a lesser status? And has the media caught up with the new older American? Or are we still kind of one of those groups that you can joke about, you can send birthday cards about aging that are really about decrepitude? So tell us where we fit in this whole imagery of America.
You're 100% right that our country was sort of brought up on the fact that youth is to be espoused and wonderful, and old age not so much. And we don't talk about it, we don't see it, we don't look at it. That's one of the reasons we thought, borrow my glasses, to even see this phase of life for what it really is today. I would say advertisers have been slow, and the media has been really slow to kind of catch on to the power, the buying power, for instance, of this generation. So when you look at research and you think about who has disposable income in our country, it's not young people, it's not people saddled with college debt, it's not people raising young families, it's older adults.
And when I go out at different times of the day now, because I have that flexibility, I see a lot of older folks like me shopping, buying with carts that are aplenty. So you're absolutely right.
Yeah, so that's one piece of it. So advertisers, I really think, are missing out in terms of not courting the older generation more. And when we started this conversation, you were talking about brand loyalty. I think that's not necessarily true anymore. And especially as baby boomers are aging, they're not going to be so loyal to the particular brand. If there's another reason to try a different type of product, they will. So I think that advertisers have a long way to go. I have a whole greeting card rant that I think I should possibly spare you, or go for it.
Yeah.
So greeting cards are an indicator, and it's one piece of popular culture, like the media, right? And what we see on TV. And I have a big issue with greeting cards. So if you picture yourself in a greeting card aisle in a card store, food store, wherever you buy greeting cards, you will find no shortage of cards that make fun of aging and older adults. And, you know, every once in a while, you're like, that's funny. I mean, some of them are pretty funny. There are, you know, well-paid people sitting there trying to be as creative as possible. So they are funny on occasion. But what's not funny is if you think about any other gender, race, ethnicity, age group, where it would be so funny.
So it's still okay to make fun of aging.
And that's the point. It's not okay, but somehow collectively, culturally, societally, we do think it's okay to make fun of older adults. And it bothers me to no end. So we have a segment in our Disrupt Aging curriculum that we've created about greeting cards. And the kicker of it is, because, you know, people will say, are you just trying to be politically correct and oversensitive and taking it all too seriously. And there is some of that. Again, the occasional funny card is great, but the sheer volume of cards in that category make it not so great. And we do have about 25 years of research with someone named Becca Levy is kind of the internationally renowned researcher in this area, along with others. And we know that messages that we get about aging and messages we give ourselves about aging actually impact us. So the idea of, hey, let's think twice about what are we saying? What are we saying in a greeting card? What are we saying in person? What messages are we giving to others and to ourselves? There really is a consequence to that.
Well, gerontology is kind of a new area because I don't think there are enough gerontologists. I don't think there are enough doctors who are dealing with elderly folks because it's a very different thing that you need to look at in various signals and such. But recently, we did a podcast with Jonathan Rauch, and he's written the book, The Happiness Curve. And with this new empirical data that he has, he is saying quite definitively that 49 is a low point in the way people look at life. I mean, they've been able to target it right to 49. And at 50, that curve goes up. And that a lot of that has to do, I think, with the sandwich generation. It has to do with all the external expectations people have. Gee, has my career gone where I thought it should go? Did I achieve what I thought? And how am I doing in relation to Joe next door? And you get to a certain point where you shed all of those concerns, and it's just like, hey, I'm so glad to be here. I'm having such a great time. I have my health. Yes, I'm going to more wakes and funerals, and I really, you know, bemoan the fact that that's necessary. But on the other hand, I'm just having the time of my life. So put that into context for me, both of you.
Well, you know, you bring up a really interesting point, and that is that almost all research does talk about the fact that as we age, we do become happier. And why is that? Well, we're shedding a lot of the things that were preconceived notions, because guess what? We're in the middle of it. And it's not bad. It's not all those negative things that everybody was talking to us about. One of the things that we talk about in our program is really start to think about what's that internal conversation that you have, that little voice that's in your head. Is it telling you negative things about your aging, or can you change it so it's giving you positive messages? And if you're thinking positively, you're going to be speaking positively, and then everything about you starts to change. And so it's the inside to the outside. You're not going to change everybody. But if you can start to change the way we talk about things, the way we expect things, one of the things that in our program is we talk about what people's expectations were for things like, gee, when I hit 65, I'm not going to be able to drive. Guess what? People are really able to drive for quite a significantly long time. And so the expectation of what's happening versus the reality of people in that age cohort are two very, very dissimilar things. And I think the more that we don't have the segregation between ages, the more we're seeing that. We've got the role models. I mean, you're right. Look at some of our government officials. They're very, very active well into ages where normally in an earlier time, folks would not be doing that. And they're doing it in a very effective manner. We may not always like it, but it's effective. So I think that's one of the critical things that we have to think about, is that how we think about our lives, how we think about our aging, how we think about our health, all impacts the reality of our existence. Wouldn't you agree, Donna?
I absolutely agree, and I think it even goes into other realms. And so in the Disrupt Aging program that AARP, Connecticut, and Borrow My Glasses put together has actually three phases. We've been talking mostly so far about disrupt aging. We call it disrupt aging community, the kind of messages that people out in the community give each other, give themselves, and we're really seeking to transform attitudes about aging because that opens up so much. But we go into two other phases, and they may be doing this in other parts of the country as well. People should look locally and figure out what's happening near them. But disrupt aging at work is another area that we're talking with people about. So if you think about, rather than sitting with a community group, if you were sitting with an organization and saying, this aging trend is coming, this aging trend is here, what is your organization doing differently? Just as families and individuals haven't really caught up with the reality of aging today in their mindset and their activities, I mean, the way they think about activities for older people, businesses haven't either. And there are no shortage of aging issues that are impacting businesses directly. And it can be something like, how many working caregivers do you have? So caregiving is a normal stage of life now. As people are living longer, at some point they do need more assistance. And oftentimes their caregivers, their spouse or their children are still in the workforce. And so how do businesses respond to that? What about opportunities for innovation? You know, the customers that you have are changing. Their needs are changing. So what can you create as far as a product or service that might appeal to your new and changing customer? You know, these are just two. We talk about succession planning. And if you have, like in the advanced manufacturing industry, if you're having a large number of people on the cusp of retirement.
And we hear that all the time.
So there's sort of business issues. And then the third place we're going with our program is into the classroom. And so we just completed a study in 12 classrooms at two universities here where we're trying to deliver messages about aging to students. And it's news to them, believe you me. They are not thinking about this, even in healthcare fields. They're not necessarily getting training and an understanding of aging. So we're going in there trying to say, are you aware of this trend? Are you thinking about some of the implications for your major, your chosen, you know, career path? Or how this will impact you as an individual in terms of making choices in your life, maybe working on cultural or societal issues that impact the aging of your community, and so on. So it's not only as an individual, I think we really have a long way to go to have other institutions think about this.
As we discuss all this, I'm trying to figure out, as one who is kind of in a state of denial that I'm at any different phase than I ever was. I'm young at heart. I'm still very active. I exercise every day. I do so many different things. So there's one part of me that doesn't want to accept those changes or this phase on some level, or admit to, you know, the fact that I'm moving along. And then there's another part of me that says, yes, I mean, this is real. So just as there's this desire on your part in many ways to say, hey, treat us just like everybody else, but on the other hand, don't. In other words, if there's age discrimination out there, as you suggest. But do we take enough of the needs of the seniors or the vintage or whatever we want to call ourselves and really ask society, hey, we want you to think of us as really productive and part of everything, and yet we do want you to isolate these concerns and help us to remedy them. It's a confusing little blend.
It is, and I've just been reading a bunch of research about this particular issue, and as Donna points out, this caregiving. If you think about it, Rosalind Carter, one of our great...
And look at them.
Okay.
Yeah,
she's amazing. But one of the things Rosalind Carter said is there's four kinds of people in the world. There's people who are currently caregivers. There are those who have been caregivers. There are those who are going to need caregivers. And those who are being cared for. And if you look at it, that's really true. And that's true of throughout our lives. Okay, so one of the things we need as Americans, we're always trying to categorize things, right? We want to put them in neat little buckets. And I think one of the things that the boomers are doing right now is saying, break that apart. We didn't like it when we were coming through as an age cohort. We wanted to break things apart and say, we're individuals. Treat us as though we are individuals. Don't treat us as though we're all the same, because we're not. And I think they're taking that same approach as they're going through their years and saying, it's not a denial. And that's maybe the language, the way we're talking about it is different. You know, if you think about it, things that I could do when I was in my early 20s, I'm not so sure I really would want to be doing them anymore. You know, I kind of did some things that were a little scary that if I think about them now, I'm like, that was probably not the best idea. So you know, as we move through the journey of our life, and maybe that's the way we look at it, is what's our life's journey? Not that.
So we'll call ourselves, you're the apprentice because you're young. I'm the journeyman because I'm, you know, whatever age. And then I don't know what you would call the mentor or something. I mean, there's another way to look at those stages. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, that's definitely a way of looking at it because, frankly, just because somebody reaches an age does not mean, a chronological age, does not mean that they have all the characteristics that we associate with that age.
It doesn't mean anything.
It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, your chronological age is one of the least predictive things about you. And you can have someone in their 60s who's really debilitated functionally and someone who's in their 90s who's not. Can I add one thing to what you're saying?
Please.
Is that okay? So I don't see a discrepancy at all with what you're saying, that, you know, we want some things to be paid attention to. We want assists in some cases, and we want freedom in other cases. I think it kind of goes back to your words. You want the freedom as long as you can have it, right? You're concerned about, what was your third word?
Limitation.
Right, so you're concerned about limitations, but you always want connectedness. And even if you have limitations, you want connectedness. So I think there's so much about aging today for people today that's so wonderful and incredible. And thinking about it as a whole new and inspiring phase is really important. And I also know that if people get an illness or a cognitive impairment or Alzheimer's disease or dementia, that's not like throwing a switch. They still want connectedness. They still want to have freedom within the abilities that they have and the space that they have set up for themselves. That it never changes. It just, you want help with what you need help with, and you want as much freedom, and you want to be a valued member of your community.
Well, I thank you because you were able to explain what I meant better than I was. Let me ask you this in closing. There's so many places and ways we could continue this conversation, but there are some who worry about a generational divide. And I know the seniors or those who are on in years vote in large numbers. Young people, not so much, and still, even in 2018. And there are many benefits ascribed to older Americans that have the potential to leave the younger generation with a lot of debt and problems. I just worry, I don't want to see a generational divide because I think we get along so beautifully in many ways. And when I was growing up and you were growing up, you know, anyone past the age of 30, don't trust them. We don't have any of that any longer. I mean, where basically I don't see the divides that we have being necessarily age related. There's lots of other ways we split ourselves up. But do you worry at all? Because we need each other and we need to be motivated and moved by some of the technological advances that our young people are making and the way they're kind of dragging us into this wonderful new age of technology. But do you worry that perhaps the generations are really going to come into conflict because of the needs that we have or the things that we have earned that now are really getting more difficult to pay for? What do you think about that, Tia?
You know, it's interesting that you bring that topic up. I think one of the things that is going to be the most critical is keeping people active in the public sphere. I think that's one of the most important things. And I also think it's important for people to understand the difference between things that are considered entitled versus earned. Okay, so without getting too deep into the weeds with that, it's critically important to understand that there are consequences to actions. All right, one of the most important things in the whole area of caregiving is that it's mostly an informal process. If we were to pay for the kind of caregiving that is given on a voluntary, let's say, basis of people, we couldn't afford it. All right. So what do we need to do? Well, instead, what we really need to do are find ways to help support caregivers in the community so that they can continue to provide those kinds of supports. Now, how does that connect with other generations? Do you realize that one of the growing generations providing care today are millennials, which is really surprising to a lot of people? And a greater portion of their income is spent on caregiving activities than it is of somebody of my age. Now, that's remarkable. And they're doing it because they see the need, it's there, and they're doing it because that's the way they've been raised to do things. I think sometimes people make bigger distinctions between people. When you really sit down and talk with people, it's amazing how much the differences between people are overcome. And I think that's one of the critical things that we need to do. Let's not make our silos so that we are not so intergenerational. One of the reasons why our Disrupt Aging work went from community into work into the
schools,
into the classroom, was to make sure that we were having this kind of conversation and people were being exposed and experiencing each other, because the way we do education in this country really segregates people out. And we need to do that. I mean, I'm back in school right now. I'm getting a certificate in gerontology, because in the work that I do with AARP, I realized there's a lot of stuff I should learn because people think I know it and I don't. So I better get smart about this. And so one of the things that's really been fascinating is I'm in classes mostly with people who are considerably younger, and we've had some spectacular conversations, and some of the folks have really said, you know, it's really changed the way I've thought about other people. And I find that now I'll ask people who, you know, seem to be older than myself, significantly older than myself, how do you feel about this? What's going on? And I'm not so uncomfortable with asking, because you made me comfortable with the idea that it's not this cranky old person who's going to be there. You know, and I think that's it. You know, as a country, if we would just talk to each other, I think we would solve many more problems, and not just this intergenerational or this aging issue. I just think in general, we spend more time taking a position than we really do finding out about the other. What's that person really like, and what are they really thinking? Because when you meet somebody and you really get to sit across from them and have a meal with them, guess what? It's really hard not to like them, and not to find out things about them that help you live your life better.
Well, I feel as if I've almost gotten a certificate in gerontology just by talking to the two of you today. I can't thank you enough for being part of America Trends. Tia Murphy, the AARP Connecticut State President, and Donna Fettis, a gerontologist and founder of Borrow My Glasses. Let me give you both an opportunity to let us know about your organizations in terms of where we can find more information on your website and the like.
Yeah, if you go to aarp.org, you can find a lot more about aging in place, livability, disrupt aging, different programs. And I would say, really, if anyone out there is looking for a great volunteer opportunity, AARP is a great place to volunteer. There's wonderful volunteers. You get fantastic training. You get to go out into your community and make a difference where you live. And that's really critically important, I think.
Donna?
If you visit us at borrowmyglasses.com, you can learn more about our organization. So it's headed by me as a gerontologist and my twin sister, who's a producer. So we're bringing our two worlds together and helping folks in designing learning strategy, evaluation strategy. We produce workshops, events, videos, and curriculum like we've done with AARP Connecticut. So find us online.
Thank you both so much for coming by today. And we love having people in person sitting across and having a conversation. And it's been my joy, and I know people have gotten something from this discussion. Thanks again for being part of America Trends.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.